And there's no syllabus, but I want you to understand some of the basics about intellectual property, because there are three basic types, the way lawyers think, and since we're also the ones who write the laws and basically run all of this, how we think matters for this. So you've got to kind of get inside our brains. There are three types of, you don't have to stay there long, though, it's kind of an easy place. There are three types of intellectual property. Copyrights, trademarks, come on, sweetie. And lawyers run on caffeine. All lawyers run on caffeine, one of the basics of being inside our brain. There are three types of intellectual property. Copyrights are what we're here to talk about. Copyrights apply to things like books and art and software, which is tomorrow's talk. But why, that's a really stupid thing to have done. But it's intended to be the creative stuff, not the science stuff. That's patents. The distinction between copyright and patent, in addition to a lot of procedural things, which we'll get into in just a sec, think of copyrights as the artsy stuff, the books, the dances, the shows, the music. Think of processes and machines and inventions, the science stuff, the engineering stuff. That's your patents. They're doing other stuff with patents. We have business method patents being used now, which, you know, can be something as original as, hey, I thought of putting things in alphabetical order. Can I patent that? And the way the patent office is running, sometimes the answer is yes.
yes.
Oh, I came up with this neat one-click thing. No one's doing that. I invented it. Yeah, I invented the internet. and I'm going to patent it. And it might work. And then every time you all log on, you owe me money. The patent system is intended for actual inventions and sciencey things. You may have noticed I'm not one of those sciencey people, because I think they would never actually use the word sciencey stuff. I'm also, by the way, not a real hardcore tech person. Every one of you knows a great deal more about computers and everything technical than I do, and I'm not going to try to bullshit you on that. If you ask me a technical question and I look kind of like a deer in headlights, I'm going to admit, yeah, I've got no clue what you're talking about. I'm a lawyer, I do a great deal of tech law, but honestly, my technical knowledge is nowhere near y'all's. Nor am I a patent lawyer, and this is one important point about patents I want you to know. Only patent lawyers can practice in the patent law area. There are some things that we mere mortals are allowed to do. If you actually have an invention and you need to get it patented, do not speak to me or anyone like me who cannot honestly tell you, yes, I am a member of the patent bar. Ask them that. Never, ever, ever hire a lawyer to help you with patents unless he or she is a member of the patent bar. It is a separate test you have to sit for. All lawyers take a bar exam so that we're qualified to practice law. We all register and qualify within each state. It's still very jurisdictional. So your lawyer needs to be qualified to practice in the state in which you are located-ish, because, you know, we do a lot of stuff by phone and there are a lot of other issues. That minimum credential is easy. The patent bar is a big deal. You have to have taken a whole bunch of science courses, undergrad and graduate level, to be allowed to sit for the patent bar. And it's a hell of an exam, much harder than the one I took, the regular bar exam.
And we do have a patent talk tomorrow. So.
Ah, sweet. Do not hire a patent lawyer who is not a member of the bar. I mean, there's lawyers can do all kinds of shit, and we'll tell you, oh, yeah, I do that. We lie a lot. But it is malpractice for any of us to hold ourselves down as patent lawyers if we're not. Ask that question. I've had a lot of friends who hired this great guy to do patents in the end. And you've got a patent talk tomorrow from someone who does. Even better. The third form of intellectual property is trademarks. Our trademarks. Trademarks are different conceptually than copyrights and patents. Copyrights and patents are both intended to protect the author's or the inventor's rights in this cool stuff they just did. Either the cool machine you just invented or the cool book you just wrote. The idea is to protect the author's rights in those. Now, there's actually a whole, like, day-long lecture my students get about the ins and outs, exactly what the Constitution intended and how the founding fathers put that all together, and you don't have to hear that. But there's actually a lot to that. Trademarks, however, are founded on a completely different concept. That concept is consumer protection. For a trademark, and there's always a trademark. Why, look, here's a trademark. I have this so I know that when Jay walked in late with my coffee, he's not here, I can get him. When he walked in with my coffee, I knew where he had gotten my coffee. We'll find out if he got the right kind. I'll give him grief later if he got it wrong. But I can look at the outside of that cup, and I know that it's everyone's favorite overpriced caffeine product. I know that because of the trademark on it. So as a consumer, I get what I expected. I expected it on time. When someone in here probably has a red can with a white swoosh on it. In this town especially, we recognize that trademark. I know if I pick up a can that's red with a white swoosh on it, I know what's inside it. That's what trademarks are intended to do. Now, obviously, trademarks also protect valuable goodwill, valuable brand name, and all of that stuff for the people who own the trademarks. But the intention is not really to protect their goodwill and their intellectual property. It's to protect me from buying some other overpriced caffeine product inadvertently. And the standards are different. The standards are likelihood of confusion for the consumer. If you go through a trademark lawsuit, you're going to have a lot, you're going to be comparing the two marks, but it's not what lawyers think or what judges think. The standard is how likely some groggy person throwing money at you going, big caffeine, milk in it, yeah. How likely that person is to be confused. That's your standard for trademark. Trademarks are important, and we're going to talk about it a bit today, because unlike copyrights, where you're copyrighting the entire work, trademarks are the identifying figures. So things like a character name, things like the name of your work, either a game or a book or a piece of software, whatever it is, the name of the work that identifies it, your name, your company's name, those things can be trademarked, not copyright protected. So if you're trying to protect the name of the series of works that you're doing, the derivative works and everything down the line, those names, to the extent you want to protect yourself and identify your product, you're talking about trademark, not copyright. And a lot of people don't get that, and they try to copyright their name, which doesn't really work conceptually from a legal standpoint, and it doesn't give you the kind of protection. So think of those two things separately. And like I said, we'll talk a little bit about trademark, but the main purpose today was copyright, so that's where I'm going to focus. But for real people with real issues they want to protect, trademark also matters. You have to file for your trademark registration. If you care enough about your game or your software product or your anything else that you're trying to create, go ahead and register a damn trademark. It's worth doing. You can do it online. It's a pain in the ass. It really is. Until recently, they had changed. You got to love, it's the federal government, so you expect it to work about as well as you expect the federal government to work. For about a year, they had it set up so you could register your trademark online. And in fact, you had to register your trademark online. For a while, they were not accepting any paper applications. Except that the example of the trademark work that you have to submit had to be on an 8x11 piece of paper. They wouldn't let you scan it and do a JPEG or anything. No, you had to give them a piece of paper. But not the application. That had to be online. When I called and said, guys, clearly you haven't updated this. What are the what are the file format requirements for the specimen to be attached? I said, oh, no, you have to send that in on an 8.5x11 piece of, but you're not accepting paper. Oh. It took them several months to figure out that they really should pick a format and stick with it. It was kind of fun for practitioners for a while there. But the trademark application is a pain in the ass, honestly, but you can do it. You don't necessarily need to hire one of my people to do it for you. A lot of folks, if you just do a quick Google, you will find a lot of lawyers and services, really, willing to file your trademark for you for like $500 to $1,000. That's a complete ripoff. They'll do a search for you. Well, I'm thinking, since you're in this room, you can probably do a search too. What those guys are going to do for their $1,000 is Google the name and see if anything obvious comes up for someone who already has it. And then they're going to go into the trademark website, which is USPTO.gov, US Patent Trademark Office.gov. You don't have to write down, you can Google that too. If it's the Patent Trademark Office, and there's a little Boolean search engine, and you can search the trademark database to find out what other names have been registered like yours. Now, where the lawyer comes in is being able to look at the other sorts of names and advise you as to whether your name is too similar to something there. And there's a whole lot of law behind that. And at that point, a lawyer may be doing you some good, But don't pay for these silly searches, especially from those companies, because they're not even usually lawyers. You're getting some paralegal, if you're lucky, to be doing searches for you, and you're paying $1,000 for wasting your money. If you would like to pay someone $1,000 to search and register your trademark, yeah, give me a call. I'll take your money. But it doesn't need to be that expensive, and you honestly can handle it yourself. It's a pain, but you can do that. And again, if it's a name that you care about and want to use, it's a $350, $325, I think. Dollar filing fee, so it's not free, but it's worth it if it's a name that you care about. Now, copyrights are what we're really supposed to be talking about today, so we'll get back to that. Yeah? You get common law rights in a trademark you use. You get much stronger rights if you register it. And if you have common law rights in a mark you've been using, you know, someone else may have common law rights in a name you're registering. And that whole conflict is one that is, that's something that a better search will help to know what you have. It's easier now that everyone advertises on the web. You have a nice, easy, centralized place to find people. But, you know, Johnny's Pizza on the corner could have a claim over Johnny's Pizza International, the big national franchise, if they had been using their name previously. There are little geographic carve-outs to get done in a whole kind of organized way that it's handled. But yeah, by using your name, you do get some rights to it. But like I said, if it's a name that you really care about, register the damn thing because your rights are stronger. Yeah.
Do copyright and trademark need to be redone after so many years?
Trademark is a fixed term. You'll file your trademark, and 5 years later, they want to talk to you again and get some more money, and then 10 years after that, or I guess 10 years from the first date, they'll want to talk to you again and get some more money. And eventually your trademark becomes eternal, you know, kind of like getting your eternal badge here, I guess. But it's a process. They move the dates from time to time. The trademark office does kind of send you a little, hey, remember you got to renew this thing. But yeah, there are renewal times that flow from the date of filing. Yes?
Can I ask a trademark question that sort of bleeds into copyright?
And then we'll get into copyright.
Yeah,
cool.
If you, let's say you published your first novel and you've got, you know, whatever, your favorite alien race that you've made up, mm-hmm. and your, you know, favorite hero or heroine, mm-hmm. and you publish your first novel, so is it worth then, say, copywriting those things, or is there some establishment that occurs when you, trademarking those things, is there some establishment?
A trademark needs to identify the source of goods or services. So to the extent that and that's the purpose. Remember, talking about consumer protection. It's not intended to protect you or your rights or your clever alien race from someone else stealing it. It's intended for me to know when I buy a book with your alien race's name on the cover, I know who I'm getting it from. So to an extent, sometimes you could trademark your funky alien race. Sometimes, if you actually invent the alien race, you could patent them. But if you have, but generally what you're talking about is in fact copyright, which is cool because that's what we're here to talk about. So copyright, and again, with copyright, what you're looking at is the creative work. If you're inventing shit, go talk to the patent guys. Copyright is your creative work, and your creative work is intended to be protected not in the clever facts or ideas that you came up with. If I figured out where King Arthur is buried through painstaking research and a lot of luck, when I publish my book about, woohoo, I found King Arthur. Look, there's the sword. This is so cool. Oh, look, he had a coat. When I find that and publish my book, what I have protection in is not where he is or how I did it or any of those facts. What I have protection in is how I explain it to you. It's idea versus expression is the terms that lawyers use. My ideas are freely usable by anyone. They are part of the public domain. This gets into that long lecture about the intention behind the constitutional requirements for copyright. But the basics of why we have copyright protection is really not for my benefit as an author. It's for y'all's benefit because it's supposed to encourage me to create. If you protect me by giving me a limited monopoly in my work, then I'm going to be more inclined to do it. The founding fathers were fairly pragmatic. And we were at that point in history at a point where we're kind of shifting away from the old version of providing for artists, which was the guy in the castle was, you know, looked important because he kept troubadours around and he kept artists around and people commissioned, you know, the rich guys commissioned artists to paint. That's why all of the paintings were of rich guys. And they all seemed to be handsome because the rich guys were paying the artists. All of their women were attractive.
Well, actually, you know, you look at some of those paintings and they really look ugly. It's like, God, you paid the artist and that's what they came up with? What did you really look like?
But, yeah. Am I the only person who wonders that looking at some of the old paintings? I obviously have very little true education in art history because I'm thinking, God, as opposed to looking at the composition and the form. But your copyright is not going to protect your ideas. There are some lovely cases where people come up with wonderful crackpot theories. You can start with the Kennedy conspiracies. No, there were a lot of guys there. The CIA killed the president. And there are a lot of neat theories. There are a lot of interesting theories about 9/11 right now. There are a lot of neat theories about all kinds of things. Someone probably has written a lovely book about those black helicopters. Now, if you are one of those people who comes up with these great theories, if you wrote your book about the black helicopters and the alien abductions and whatever else goes along with that, were you to write it in a novel, you would actually have greater protection over your interesting theory than if you wrote it the way these folks tend to write their books, which is, the truth has now been revealed. Here's the truth about those codes on the back of the signs when you're driving down the highway. You thought it's just serial numbers for the DOT guys to know which signs, but no, it has to do with invasion plans or something. The UN guys, I think, read it when they... is it the UN that's in the black helicopters? I always kind of lose track. But anyway, if you write the book about the black helicopters to tell the truth so everyone will now know, well, guess what? That stuff you made out, discovered about the black helicopters is not part of your protected work. The ideas and the theories and the facts and anything that you come up with in your book or in your program or in whatever media you're working is not protected by copyright. That's one of the distinctions between copyright and patent. Patent, what's the facts, to the extent they're facts, the process, the actual workings of it, the substance is what's protected in patent. In copyright, what's protected is the form. It's all about the pretty. And it's the pretty that's being protected in your work in copyright. So if you invent your alien race in your novel, how you describe them, the expression you use, the language that you use, the words you are using to describe these lovely aliens, that's what's protected. Now, to the extent, hang on just a second, to the extent that you work out an intricate plot, if you're writing a book, you probably ought to do that. Some that I've read recently didn't get to that step, but you ought to. But to the extent you have interesting characters, big one for games, because continuing characters count there. Same with novels. You have a series, you want your characters to be protected. You want some of your basic plot to be protected. In copyright, the way that's going to work is the more particularly you describe your character, the more intricate your plot is, the more original your plot and your character and your devices and whatever other cool shit you do, the more original that all is, the better your protection is going to be. If I write a story, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, sad. If that's my story, there's not a whole lot original there. There are a whole lot of books and plays and all sorts of things that are written with that basic plot line. Or boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back, other stuff happens. Yeah. If you don't have something truly original in your plot, you don't have much of a copyright there. To the extent you get more and more original, you get better protection. And with characters, there's a whole lot of cases trying to define when you actually own, if you will, a character. If I have a stock character in my book, the Irish cop, the drunken lawyer, the the absent-minded professor, which I'm also called on a regular basis these days, the scary night-dwelling goth, the pale-skinned, computer screen glow, illuminated geek, any of those just stock characters, you didn't make that up. You didn't come up with that yourself, so guess what? You don't own it. You're not going to get to own something that's basic. Now, if you develop a particular scary goth person and give them characteristics perhaps beyond avoiding that evil day star and beyond the traditional recreational activities of those people, then you may actually start to have something protectable. A couple of y'all may have read these books that came out recently. It's kind of a YA thing. Harry Potter, I think it was called. One or two of you may have read that. There you have a lot of different characters, some of which really are unique, a lot of which really aren't. The basics of that book are not something that the nice rich lady now who wrote them can own. Kid discovers he has magic. I think we've read a few of those books in our times. So kid discovers he has magic, yeah, not so much. Kid discovers he has magic and gets to go to school to learn how to do it. Okay, a little more original, but still, yeah, we've read a bunch of those. She doesn't own that. Kid discovers he has magic, goes to school, some funny stuff happens, fights some bad guys, makes some friends. We're still not real original yet. But somewhere between the basics of discovers he has magic, goes to school, makes friends, fights evil, saves the world, she adds some stuff. She adds some details. She adds some scarves. If you can costume it, it probably is well-developed character. If you don't really know what they look like and you don't really know how to costume it, yeah, chances are they didn't define the characters real well. She did a great job, actually, of writing for lawyers because she threw in enough stuff, and for marketing. She threw in enough interesting details and really made the world thick with those details, which I do a lot of licensing work. When I read the first of her books, I'm like, oh my God, she can license all this crap. And, you know, sure enough, now you walk into any store and you can buy licensed versions of that. Most novels, if you think about it, you don't read them and have a whole lot you can license out of them. I mean, you look at Tolkien, now obviously that's a different issue, but he's got all kinds of very thick texture and detail, but he didn't come up with kind of his little licensing hooks. Different age, different way to write. That's something that interests lawyers. Y'all just read the books and enjoy them that way. But, so with copyright, it's your expression that counts. It's how you describe it, and to the extent that you own a character, or an alien race, or a plot device in your book, it's because you made it thick, texturally detailed, and original. Originality is the hook for copyright. If it's original and you created it, you probably own some of it. But you own it only to the extent that it was original and you created it. I'm sorry, you had a question.
Yes, it was about characters.
Okay, which since that's right, I figured we were about to leave that, so I wanted to answer the question on it. Go ahead.
Yes. You've spoken about characters in books. How about if you're an artist and you create a character? Do you have a right over just the way that you drew that character in that one pose? Or is there a way that you can have a copyright over any interpretation of the character?
It really doesn't matter in copyright which media you work in. The analysis is going to be the same. Usually people in traditional copyright subjects don't think of continuing characters in art. It's just not something that there's a lot of case law on, honestly. So the law is not real well developed in that area. The basic logic will be the same, however. You can't own the idea of nude on unicorn. You can't own that. You can own your expression of nude on unicorn. And it's the sense that, I'm sorry, I ride horses a lot. And whenever you see the people go, oh, the beautiful naked woman on the horse, like, man, you've never sat on a horse, have you? It's, again, brains are a sad thing sometimes. The character that you're going to own is what you bring to it. So the idea of how you arrange the character, the background, everything else, the form, the pretty, all of that that you bring to it, the overall impact of your art, those are the sorts of things that are going to protect it so someone can't do a knockoff of your work. One of the rights that you have as a copyright holder is the right to make derivative works. And that's the biggie. Derivative works are the knockoffs. They're the fan fiction. They're the next chapter in the adventures of whoever. It's translations are derivative works, actually. Anything that you do taking that original work and then doing something else to it, all of the stuff that fans do, that's derivative works. And that's an infringement if you don't have permission to do it. The fan magazines, yeah, it's all infringing. Most times, the copyright holders in those cases don't mind it because it's good for the franchise. But they have the right to stop it. How to stop it is a different issue. Did that kind of answer your question? Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How do you properly encourage the fans' derivative works without giving away your copyright protection rights?
We're going to get to the Creative Commons guides and ideas like that in just a second. If I don't get there, remind me. You notice I don't actually have a structured lecture I'm going on this day. The idea with copyright, let me give you just the basic dynamics of what copyright will do for you and how to do it. Copyright, as I said, is going to protect your expression. One of the, so it's not going to protect your ideas. I'm going to keep saying that over and over because people keep forgetting that. I came up with this really cool idea, and I'm very happy for you. Continue to have them. But you can't protect them with copyright. If it's really, really good and sciencey, you know where I'm going with that, you might be able to patent it.
But if it's just a really cool idea, well, describe it really nicely and your description will be protected in copyright. That's it. You cannot protect the underlying ideas, facts, or anything like that in copyright. And I'll keep saying that. And someone after is going to come up and say, I have this really great idea. And I'm going to say, yeah, you did. Keep having them. Remember when I said that earlier? Yeah. And don't protect your copyright. Copyright is not hard to do. In fact, if you are writing a book, you already have a copyright in it. As soon as you fix something in a tangible media, and it has now been established, it took them a while, but computer counts as a fixed media. Digital counts. At first, since we're lawyers, we had to be really confused and concerned about that, whether that was a fixed medium or not. It is, so we're cool. But as soon as you write it, as soon as you paint it, as soon as you sculpt it, it is protected. What is not protected and may affect some of y'all is performance. I think we actually are being recorded here. So to the extent that I am being recorded, then that counts as fixed in a tangible media, and my speech, such as it is protected by copyright. None of the facts in it are, just the way I say it. What value is in that is questionable, but that's what's protected. My actual notes in here, those are copyright protected. I didn't file any federal forms for this, I assure you, but my actual notes are protected. My performance of those notes is not. My performance is not fixed. That's a fixed version that counts. Arguably, if I were reading a book that I wrote to you, that's a performance of that book. Probably pretty boring. But that would be a performance. The right to perform is also something protected by my copyright in my book. So no one else can perform it without my permission. But the performance itself is not protected unless it's fixed. So if you are a dancer and you are doing choreography, which is something that can be a copyrighted thing, you are going to need to video the damn thing so that you can copyright it. Your written notes can also count, but fix it in a tangible medium means fix it in a tangible medium. Don't screw around the edges of it, just make it recorded. So you do not have to file for federal copyright. If you have a serious work that you care about, file for a federal copyright. It gives you greater rights. It gives you a little greater protection. Most of them are really just if things go bad, your lawyers have a few more sticks to beat other people with. But it's easy to do copyrights. Never, ever pay one of my people to register your copyright. For the love of God, it's the easiest thing in the world to do. Go online. It asks for your name. It asks for the name of the work. It asks for your address and a copy of the work. And you're done. It's not the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. That would be Patents and Trademarks. The Copyright Office is run through the Library of Congress if you Google them and find their site. The Copyright Office's site looks remarkably like not a government site. They change how it looks every now and again. The Trademark Patent Office site looks exactly like a government website. If you go to the copyright site and you think, oh, I got someone else's site that just managed to get higher on the search engine, no, that's actually it. It just looks off. I don't know why, but it does. Yeah, you had a question.
When you have like a work like that that you're more serious about, at what point should you bother to copyright it? Because like sometimes you write a draft and you're like, well, this is a good draft and it's pretty close to what I think I'm going to send to an editor, but you might end up, you know, editing.
Send the finished version. And this whole bit about mailing it in an envelope to yourself and stuff, that's ideas people have out there, yeah, don't do that. It doesn't do you a bit of good. When you write the book, as you're writing it, what is fixed on your computer, on your paper, wherever you're writing, that is protected. You have rights to that. Now, obviously, there's a difference between having rights and being able to actually enforce them meaningfully. And that's a big problem in any area of intellectual property. But we start with make sure you have the rights. Then we can move into how are you going to actually meaningfully enforce them. And the reality is, if you're working on a draft at home and you're not showing it to people, no one's going to steal it. So you're not really concerned about how exactly you're going to protect it at that point. When you have a work that's finished and you like it and it's pretty much what you're going to be doing, then by all means, go ahead and send that one in and have that one copyrighted. You don't have to necessarily wait for the absolute final version, but you want to make sure that you have a final. Don't be sending every week's revision in. I mean, it's $35, something like that, to file. So there is a little bit of money involved. It's just it honestly doesn't matter terribly. Usually what's going to get filed is the final version that's being published. You can do it ahead of time. And again, I say that it doesn't matter, and that's kind of from a real
negative, pragmatic approach. If you're sending it to a crooked editor who's going to steal it, having filed it with the copyright office, isn't going to keep them from stealing it from you. If you're dealing with a legitimate publishing house, they're not going to steal it. And so filing in advance just looks a little weird. And normally in the publishing industry, since you do have copyright protection by virtue of having written it, it's not that your work is unprotected again. Remember, your copyright exists when you write it. When you write the book, your copyright exists. When you sculpt the clay, your copyright and the sculpture exists. You don't have to file it. So when you send it off to the publisher, you already have a copyright protection in that. Some publishers think you're a little weird if you put the little copyright notes at the bottom. They don't like to see that because it makes them think that you're one of those weird folks. I've heard from publishers on both sides of that. Some of them say, yeah, everyone does that. We don't care. The little C in a circle with the date and the name used to be the law. Before 1976, if you did not have that little copyright notice on your work somewhere, you lost your copyright. Lawyers liked that system. We got a lot of work out of that system because every time someone inadvertently left the copyright notice off of something, there was a big lawsuit when someone stole it. They said, no, I still have a copyright that. No, you don't. You published it without notice. Ha ha ha. And the lawyers scurried around and got rich. The way that we have the process now, notice is not necessary. You do not have to have a little C with your name, all rights reserved. If you're publishing stuff, though, on the internet or in like real dead tree form, put that on there. You don't have to anymore. If you fail to do so, you are not losing your copyright. If you are looking at a website, therefore, that does not say all rights reserved, really don't steal this, you dorks, that doesn't mean that you can steal it. By virtue of someone having created that website, they technically own the creative elements of that website. So, no, you can't steal it. But most people think that if the notice isn't on there, then you can take it. So if you want to protect your works, even though you don't have to, and I do want to make sure that y'all know, you do not have to put that notice on there, put it on there. Because other people will see that. It's kind of like locking your car doors. Someone who wants to steal your car can still bloody well steal your car, but it'll keep the honest people honest as they walk by. So put the copyright notice on your work because it'll keep some honest people honest. And it will also keep people from taking your stuff thinking they're allowed to. Just put some on notice. No, really, I do care about this. Don't steal my shit. And put that on there, and it'll keep some people from doing it. Yeah.
It wasn't, didn't J.D. Salinger stop somebody from publishing his letters?
I'm not familiar with that particular case, but...
He stopped because people want to publish his letters.
Oh, sure.
To other people. He says, no, I own the copyright.
And he does.
He stopped, and that was like back in the 50s, and yeah. He stopped him from publishing.
Yeah. Anything that I write, I have the ownership of. If someone owns the copies of my letters, that's not the same as owning the rights and the underlying work. That's absolute square one of copyright. This is a book. See, there's something I'm teaching law students. There are a lot of books around, so I can pick up my big-ass book and use this as my point at it for the next 5 minutes kind of example. The Hacker Quarterly. What a hoot. Okay. I own this book because I just stole it from whoever left it there. I do not own the stuff in the book. The whatever valuable information and stuff is in here, these articles aren't mine, but I can own this copy of it. So someone had possession of his letters and had possession of the paper and owned the physical copy. This is, you know, basic copyright stuff. I can own the physical copy. I can sell you the physical copy. And want to give me some money for the, summer 2007 Hacker Quarterly? I could sell you this. I could rip it into 1,000 pieces. Scott might be angry because it might be his. I could rent it to you. I can do anything I want with this physical copy. I have no rights to the stuff inside it, the valuable information and articles and whatever else is in here. So the guy who owned the copy of Salinger's letters was able to do a lot of things with those. Publishing them is one of the things he can't do because that's getting to the intangible rights to the stuff in the book. So you can't publish it. You can't copy it. I can do a lot of things to this. I can't copy it. Not legally.
Courtney.
Yes?
What about a synopsis? Can you publish a synopsis of what?
Yes. Since you don't own the information in it, I can read this and write a review of it, which would be funny because I probably wouldn't understand one word in 10. But I can do critical analysis, and that's actually one of the very protected free uses. I can read a book and write a book review of it. I could spoil the ending of the Harry Potter book like I did in the New York Times. I can do a lot of things
with the information from the book, and something that is supposed to be critical analysis is the sort of thing that the copyright system wants to encourage. So yeah, you're absolutely allowed to do that. I could tell you what he said in those letters, but I couldn't publish the actual letter. So any information in there about, wow, he had a dog named this, and oh, he had these girlfriends and these boyfriends, and you know, whatever cool salacious gossip was in there, I could pull out that gossip and tell you about it, or publish my own take on the cool stuff he was doing. But I couldn't publish the actual letters. He owned the rights to what, to how he said it. The facts in them are like where King Arthur's buried. Once those facts are written down, everyone's free to use them. You have a question?
If you don't have to register a copyright, if you just have one when you make something, how does anyone know that it was you who made it?
That's one of the reasons you register.
That's why it costs $10,000 to $20,000 to defend your copyright.
That's kind of getting us into the next stage, which is a great way to do this. On a practical level, register the stuff that's important. Don't register everything you've ever done, because it'll just take you forever. And yeah, the $30 a time adds up. But one of the reasons that you register the copyright is so people do know who you are. That's why I put the copyright notice on your work. Even though it's not required, put the copyright notice, put your name, put your damn email so people can contact you and ask for permission to use your stuff. It's one of the things about publishing now that's interesting is that in the academic world, it's turned kind of strange. Y'all remember getting this annoying course packs in school where the professors wanted to go, you know, this chapter of this book and this article and that, and so you had to go pay for, you know, $30 from Kinko's for the course packs. Well, Kinko's gotten a lot of lawsuits over those, because at some point in academic publishing, as well as in normal publishing, there's only like two publishing houses left. Everything's conglomerized so much, there's really only two. It used to be every university published their own stuff. So if you wanted to use some professor's work, you had to not only figure out which professor wrote it, okay, that's not too hard, professors are good at putting their names on stuff, but then you had to figure out which school actually owned the copyright, because usually the schools that owned it for a while, that varies over time too. So, and not just the school that the professor worked for now, which you could usually find out, but where he had actually worked when he published the paper or the book or whatever, because each university tended to have their own little press. And so each university would have certain rights to what professors had written when they worked at those universities. And especially if you can imagine briefly, it'll scare you a little bit, but imagine a time before computers, before the internet, when everything was what's his CV? And pull up a professor's CV online, and it's easy to do. Not everyone knew that. So gathering that information was actually fairly difficult. And it was hard to track down the rights holders of obscure academic crap to get permission to use it. So the law kind of developed around that, and developed in a way that most professors had a particular right to reprint other stuff for educational use. It actually ended up in the current code. There is an express carve-out for academic use. You can copy stuff and hand it out in a classroom. Notwithstanding that express carve-out, professors and Kinko's are being sued for making copies of crap and handing it out in their classroom. And you look at the code and say, look, here it says I can do this. And then you read the Supreme Court opinion saying, no, you can't do that. Okay, then. One of the reasons the law is now kind of developing back the other way, notwithstanding the clear wording in the code that you're allowed to do it, is that since there are only two publishing houses now, and everyone can find who the publisher is, you can call and ask permission very easily. And most of the publishers, except there are only two left, they're huge, they have lots of staff, and they have set scales for how much it's going to cost to license use of that article for your course. So you're now expected to ask permission, which is generally why you want to make sure that your name and some contact info, if you're not publishing through the publishing house, so that someone who wants to use your stuff can ask. Make it easy for someone to ask for permission from you. They may not still, but the easier you make it for them to find you, for them to know, yes, I have rights in this book, yes, I protect them, yes, I take it seriously, I would like you to do so. If you can make that clear by putting the copyright notice on, by putting some contact info on, which is not the law, but it makes sense, you're more likely to be able to protect your work.
Can't you also, if you're trying to save the money, you can copyright a compilation of all the work?
You can copyright anything you want.
Yeah, I mean, you can have like 10,000, if you have written like 10,000 short stories, you can send all 10,000 at one time and under for $40, whatever.
Right.
Yep.
Absolutely. If you call the work your anthology, then it's going to be protected in that. And there's a whole different level of what's protected and what isn't. If you find old poetry, for instance, written 800 years ago by dead people, well, not dead when they wrote it, dead now,
If you find something written by dead people, that's a different track, I think.
They're zombies.
Yeah, it's a zombie track. It's down the hall. But if you have stuff that's in the public domain, Shakespeare. If you wanted to put together a collection of Shakespearean sonnets, yeah, Shakespeare doesn't still own a copyright, but the ones you select and how you arrange them and how you present them, you actually have copyright in that selection, the creativity and originality that you express in the selection of the works. It does not give you protection over the actual Shakespearean sonnet. You can't own something that's in the public domain. If you do something very clever to it, making that anthology of the Shakespearean sonnets is a derivative work. That's one of those rights that the rights hold that the author actually has, but since the sonnets are now in the public domain, you can use them. But you can't kind of pull them back out and say, ooh, since I copyrighted my anthology, ha ha ha, now I own that sonnet. Doesn't work that way. Yeah.
If you do just one compilation of an anthology of your work,
of your original works, then you get the whole shebang. Okay. Yes. Your original work, since you do in fact hold the copyright, just filing it once is fine. It doesn't change your substantive rights at all. You're not going to be able to increase your substantive rights by clever filing practices. You own what you own. And nothing about filing or what you call it or how you do it or putting it in an envelope and mailing it to yourself or any of those things, none of that's going to change the substantive rights you have. You file it so that you have a better record of it, so the government knows you own it because the government likes to know things, so you can give them their $30 because they like getting your money. But it makes it easier for you to protect, to stand up and say, look, I have the copyright. And it's kind of cool to think that somewhere in the Library of Congress, somewhere in the basement, your work is actually on file at the Library of Congress. It's kind of cool. And that really was one of the things that the copyright system was started through the Library of Congress back in the days of real books. This was kind of the government's way of getting free shit for their library. If you were going to copyright your work, you had to send a copy of the book to the Copyright Office. The Copyright Office is run through the Library of Congress, and a lot of the works in the Library of Congress, they didn't have to buy, because, yeah, you have to send us a copy, because we're the government, we're clever. Yeah.
Can you comment briefly on fair use policies, I guess, outside of academic criticism? Are there other jurisdictions or, you know, where that would apply?
Fair use is a big area, and this is great. Y'all kind of give me my segues. Like, okay, you've been talking for this long, it's time for you to move to your next topic. Fair use is an exception to your protection in your work. I wrote my book, I therefore own the rights to my book. If you buy my book, buy my book. If you buy my book, you can do lots of things to the physical copy. I remember I was telling you, if you do lots of things to the physical copy, I can't copy it, I can't make a new derivative work out of it, I can't do anything to the cool substantive stuff inside without the author's permission, except. Now, we talked about doing criticism of Salinger's letters. I can write a review. There are a lot of other things I can do through fair use. And fair use, this is a number of long lectures in my class, because fair use has been really expanded in a huge and stupid way. And there's a guy here in town who's responsible for it. Brilliant lawyer, litigator, you know, but brilliant litigator. And he just has clients who want the wrong things. And he's so good that he wins cases and makes bad law. If you ever needed a good lawyer and had a lot of money, go hire Joe Beck because he's fabulous. But damn it, he keeps screwing up the law by winning cases that he shouldn't have won. Fair use is one of them. Fair use is your right to use someone else's protected work. The idea behind fair use is supposed to be that I can critique someone else's work. I can talk about someone else's work. If I want to excerpt a small part of someone else's work, for good reasons, like to use in my work, to use for academic is a big one because we're supposed to be talking and clever and critiquing and improving the world is the whole idea behind copyright again. So if I can, if I want to be inspired by your work, I can use pieces of it for purposes that don't actually take away your rights. If nothing I'm doing is going to impact the sale of your book, then I can probably do it. That's what fair use is meant to be. I can, for instance, there was a case with a television show, they had a quilt thrown over the back of the bed, and they had a poster on the wall, just on the set. Well, the woman who had designed the poster, and eventually the folk artist who had made that quilt, go figure, sued, saying, you displayed my art on your television show. Yeah, and they're like, we did what? Oh, that thing on the wall? I bought it at Poster Hut. So to speak. And what do you mean I'm infringing your copyright just because it's on the wall? Huh? That's the sort of fair use thing. I'm allowed to buy art and hang it on the wall. Now, if I were doing an art gallery exhibit of your stuff, then I'm displaying it and it's like performing your art, and that's different. If it's just tangentially in the background while I'm doing something else, that's okay. It's a minimal use. It's fair to do that. That's why we call it fair use. Because, you know, oh, come on. If we're going to be fair, yeah, we can use little snippets of crap. Sampling is just a little snippet, but that takes it too far, because you're really using that work not just to help your song along. You're just stealing my little catchy tune because you're too lazy to come up with your own. Or because you like my soundbite so much, you want to use it in your work. Well, you know, at that point, you're taking my rights. You're not just hanging my quilt on your wall. You're taking my rights. And that's kind of where the boundary is. I could give you a whole lot of long legal rules about it, but the cases are all over the map. So the very distinct legal rules don't terribly matter because we're just mangling them right now. We're at a point right now in the law where fair use is just being ripped into strange, stupid directions. And the idea, but so understand the basic of fair use, which is it's supposed to be a use that's, you know, fair, the way normal humans use that word. Is it fair to do that? Yeah. If you're sampling my work for use in your work and you're going to make a lot of money and my voice is going to be sampled somewhere in your work, hell yeah, you got to pay me for that. If you're doing a stage production and you happen to have my poster hanging in the back, that's probably okay. But if you're using someone else's work in any sort of derivative fashion, ask for permission. It's what you would want them to do for your work, so ask for permission. Do, you know, do unto others and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
Okay, this is, I've seen a number of cases in, where people, especially in the arts and crafts world, they'll take somebody's piece and they'll do a teach a class on how to make something just like this other person's, and they're claiming academic on that. Is that stretching extremely far, or is that snapping?
There are two different issues, I think, there. You see, some people who will say, okay, here's this beautiful original piece of artwork, and I'm looking at this art in the back, and it's just really ugly, so I can't really use it as an example. I usually like to like point those in, kind of like this, but I don't even know what I would say about those. So we'll go back to this. Look, a lovely photograph of Mayan ruins. Okay, we're now using this for artistic purposes, not for substantive book purposes. If I were to say, okay, I'm going to teach a... Oh, there's a Zeppelin up in there. That's kind of cool. I'm going to teach a class in how to take pictures like this. I can use this as an example. We can talk and we can critique the camera crap that has to do with this photograph. And if I wanted to teach you how to make that sort of lighting effect occur, I can teach that. And we can use this and talk about it, and that's fine. If I wanted to show you how to set up that same shot, that's fine too. If I wanted to teach you how to make a knockoff so that you can make a copy of this work, I can teach you how to do that. Making that copy, however, might be an infringement. Copying someone's work, no matter how you do it, whether it's done with a Xerox machine or a pen and paper or listening and singing, you know, however you copy someone's work, that act of copying is an infringement. Talking about it's not. Talking about how to do it is exactly the kind of conversation that the copyright gods want you to have. But actually making the copy may well be an infringement. And again, it depends on the work and what kind of rights are in the work and a whole bunch of other very particularized case-by-case kind of analysis. But if I want to teach you how to do it, that's fine. Does that answer the question? Sorry, he says. Okay.
So basically the instructor might be safe, the students are all copying.
We set it up that way on purpose. Again, you can talk about works, you can critique them, you can... But the actual copying and recreating of them might be an issue. That presumably the professor has actually done the copies also, so it would also be in the same handbasket. In copyright protection, there are how you can actually practically protect your work is going to vary a lot based on what your work is. And that's where it gets a little bit hedgy. I know that we're for artists and authors, I think is our tagline. We're in the EFF track, so a lot of y'all are computer folks. So what your work is going to affect the best way to protect it. Software, obviously, is different than a novel. Everything has kind of gotten weird by becoming digital. Now, lawyers are really bad at tech, as a general rule. I'm really bad at tech, and I'm actually much better than most of my brethren. So we don't understand technology terribly well, and the law tends to lag behind anything technical. We're just kind of getting the hang of how copyright law attaches to motion pictures. We're pretty sure we understand that now. There's still a little bit of haziness between screenplays and the actual movie, and there are some unclear areas of law there. Movies have been around a little while. So there's definitely some gray areas when you're dealing with the technology stuff. And the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA, which is actually kind of an acronym you can actually remember because it's almost like the Village People, but not quite, is kind of a lawyer's approach to saying, wow, we've got all of this tech crap now in copyright area. And some of this is what I'll be addressing tomorrow. We have to figure out a way to deal with the fact that things can be copied so much more easily now. The music industry is the one that's being hit biggest by this, because the print folks freaked out when Xerox machines were invented. Because suddenly, instead of having to laboriously recopy a book, you could just Xerox the puppy, and that was scary for authors. Because it wasn't just publishers now who could publish their book. Anyone can Xerox stuff. Okay, y'all can Xerox stuff. You know, it takes forever to do. But the whole Kinko's industry, copy shops, really did start having an impact on authors' sales because people could copy for free. Not free. But you can, your books can be published by other people that way. Once it went digital, it was even scarier. But again, for the print industry, it's not as huge an impact, obviously, as it has been for the recording industry. The recording industry is a lovely example of how just to be stupid about technology, because they really could not have bungled it much worse than they really did. We have some lovely Supreme Court cases when we started to have the VCRs and those kinds of things. It's actually fun. Okay. Fun for me. Not necessarily fun the way you would describe that word. To go back and read the Sony cases and the Betamax cases and those kinds of things. Because the Supreme Court justices, pretty much any time you see the Supreme Court opining on something technical, go read the opinion and buy stock in the company that's the opposite of what the Supreme Court says is going to happen. They were pretty convinced that Betamax was going to take off because it's the better technology. They had great ideas about when the VCR cases first came out. The Supreme Court's, you know, a bunch of smart folks and rogues, came up with really neat ideas about what people would and wouldn't do with home recording technology. Because they were absolutely certain that no one would ever record things off of television and keep those copies of what they recorded. They were absolutely certain no one would ever do that. Okay, most of y'all have a whole bunch of stuff you've taped off of, not taped now, but burned off of HBO. And libraries of it. Yeah, everyone does. And the Supreme Court said, of course, no one would ever do that. That's how good they are predicting human behavior and human behavior around technology. They get even stupider. So the Supreme Court's issue with that, the recording industry, oddly enough, was even dumber. They, you know, because y'all may have noticed when digital formatting started coming out with music, on music, and you were able to have first the digital audio tapes and then the whole MP3 stuff. Napster noticed. A lot of other file sharing organizations, that's not a good word for it, systems noticed that this is kind of cool. The music industry kept saying, what are you talking about, Napster, huh? And the whole Napster series of cases are incredibly dull from a legal standpoint. Because, yeah, it's infringement, duh. That's it for legal. There's nothing interesting about Napster. We don't care what format it is you're copying stuff in. If you're copying it and someone else has the rights to it, you're breaking the law. Napster was absolutely illegal activity. End of story. Yeah, there were some songs on Napster that the artists allowed to be copied. Okay, those weren't illegal. The rest of it is. And it's not, the fact that it's on the internet, the fact that it's digital, makes no difference whatsoever. I told you before, the media in which you create your work is irrelevant. The media in which you steal someone else's work is also irrelevant. If someone else owns it, you can't steal it. Just because you're putting it on a peer-to-peer file server, yeah, no, I don't care how you're sharing it, and you call it sharing, that's so cute. No, it's stealing. It doesn't matter that you're doing it digitally, you're still stealing. And from a legal standpoint, there was nothing interesting there. What was, from a practical standpoint, interesting is the music industry was stupid and sat there and said, yeah, we're going to sue Napster. That'll fix the problem. Okay. So after suing Napster, and putting them out of business and then back up and then back out and then back up for a while. Some lawyers got very rich off of that entire process. So now, of course, that Napster has been pretty much shut down but then brought back, I think it's back again still, obviously no one can share music on the internet. We took care of that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, wait, they're still doing it. Quick, send some college students. That'll work. It made big news a couple years ago when they said, we're going to prove that we still have rights. We're going to just, you know, pick a few targets and sue them, and that'll show everyone. Yeah, that worked. So a few people really had a miserable time. They really were targeted by very expensive lawsuits. And if you're targeted by a very expensive lawsuit, you have to go buy your own very expensive lawyer. Normal humans can't buy very expensive lawyers. And so it was fairly traumatic. Obviously, you got involved. Law folks donated some legal time. And eventually, those folks all settled out of court, and it went away. And everyone hated the recording industry that much more for having sued little old ladies and college students for no apparent reason. And again, you can see how well that worked because, yeah, no one's sharing music illegally on the internet now. That's one of the things that the DMCA was supposed to address. It was intended to help with this kind of piracy by making it illegal to counteract copy protection, technical copy protection measures. That seems reasonable because it was like one little glimmer of good thought in the midst of a whole world of stupid. That they said, you know, we're going to try to put copy protection on our stuff. We're going to sell CDs, and we're going to try to have CDs that you can't burn copies off of. We're going to try to have stuff in our video games so you can't hack them and change it and make your own game out of our game. We're going to try to have protection in the chips so that you can't go and modify the chips and do your own stuff. I don't know why we have different formats geographically for different games and different videos, but we're going to do that too, just because, I guess. The logic there escaped me. But we're going to do these things to try to protect our works, we being the recording industry, the publishing industry, the authors in theory behind those industries. We're going to try to protect our works through technical means, but we're not that stupid. We know that the hackers are going to be right with us and ahead of us pretty much the whole way. You can't out-program the hackers. So we're going to put the protections we can on our work, but we want to make sure that not only is copying our work illegal, but getting past even just the thing of breaking through our protections is supposed to be illegal. Breaking and entering is your thing. If breaking and entering into someone's house is illegal, before you steal anything, breaking and entering is illegal. DMCA was really intended to make breaking and entering through the technical protections illegal. This is good if you own copyright stuff. If you're trying to be creative and if you're one of the mod guys, if you want to do some fan stuff that they might or might not allow you to do, getting past that technical stuff is a pain in the ass. Most of y'all can probably do it because, again, the hackers are always better than the official protectors. But that's what the DMCA is supposed to do. There's a lot of hatred about that particular act because it was a neat idea, but it is applied strangely. Another aspect of the DMCA, this is just kind of a little modern addition to the Copyright Act, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, is supposed to help figure out who is liable for stuff on the internet. Some people behind that were the folks who actually are, yeah, the big ISPs, basically, who are saying, okay, if just hypothetically, if copyright violations were occurring on the internet, we want to make sure, you know, if I'm Yahoo, I want to make sure that I'm not going to get sued for the copyright infringement when someone posts someone else's work. So there's a whole Byzantine structure. If you see your work, it is coming back around to a practical way to do this. If you see your work on the net, you can have it pulled down at the source by going through the particularized notice letter. You have to use certain magic rules, certain magic words, and write a letter to the hosting company and say, hey, that's my shit on your site, and you need to take it down in accordance with blah, 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 blah. And they are supposed to take it down. Then they tell the person who posted it what they've done, and that person can tell them, no, I own it. And there's a whole back and forth sort of conversation that lawyers love because we bill by the hour. And they should eventually take it down. If you are doing creative stuff on your website and someone sends you a takedown notice, the official DMCA takedown notice goes to the ISP. That's kind of cool because you can make them take this shit down at the source. So if you see your work somewhere it shouldn't be, you write to the person who did it, say, hey, that's my shit, take it down, or give me some money. And you write to the ISP saying, hey, you're posting this, you know, this is on your site, this is on, you know, stuff that's going through your system, take it down. One of those ought to work. If you receive one of those letters, yeah, be a nice person. Whatever, it means that someone does own that, and you shouldn't be stealing it, take it down. But that's, so it's intended to be an effective process. Obviously, it doesn't really deter the bad guys. And who the bad guys are varies based on who you are yourself. And a lot of industry folks think the hackers are the bad guys. The hackers tend not to see it that way. If you own a copyright in a work, the guy who's using your shit on his website is the bad guy. If you want to do something creative on your website, that horrible, selfish person who owns that stuff that shouldn't even, you know, everyone should be free to use anything, then you think the rights holder is the bad guy. So, like, the where you sit is going to depend who's the good guy and who's the bad guy, but make sure you put notices on your work. Police it. If you see your stuff up, write letters, tell them to take it down. Figure out how much you care about it and how far you're willing to go with it. A lawsuit is usually going to be the stupidest way to protect your work, because it's going to be very expensive. To the extent you can put copy protection on, I know there are ways that if you're putting photographs on the net, there are ways you can make them less copyable. Do that. Take the practical steps you can take to protect yourself. I think of protecting your intellectual property the same way you take into account protecting your personal safety. Yeah, the cops are supposed to keep you safe, and yeah, no one is supposed to be allowed to mug you because we're certain that robbing and raping and pillaging are all supposed to be illegal. You still don't walk alone at night in a dark alley. So same thing with protecting your stuff. You're going to take the steps you can that are practical. If there's a way to copy protect your work, whatever media is you work in, take those practical steps. Don't wait for my people to protect you, because we won't. Don't wait for the law to protect you, because it won't. Put your notices on, say, hey, this is mine. If you want to use this, call me and we'll talk. That'll keep some people from doing it. You're never going to keep the real bad guys from doing it. If you do catch them, that's when you call the cops or my people. Yeah.
You mentioned Creative Commons earlier. What kind of legal standing does it actually have as far as allowing people to use your work without having to constantly come ask you?
Thank you for bringing me back to that. The Creative Commons folks are interesting. It's kind of legal by other means. Basically, all you're doing is assigning a blanket license to your work. And it's becoming more enforceable. Basically, if you as the rights holder hold this bundle of sticks of rights, the right to copy, the right to do a derivative work, all this other, to perform, all these cool things you own. That's your copyright. And you can give these things away. You can give away a performance right. You can give away a derivative work right. You can sell them, you can give them away, and you can do it piece by piece. You can also do what these folks are doing. There's a number of different versions online. Lessig was the one who started Creative Commons folks, and he actually has a brain and is a lawyer, so I prefer his forms as a general rule. You're just writing a license, a blanket license, saying, hey, you can do these things with my work. And so you're making, it's interesting in that you're making very clear, I want to share, I'm a good person, please quit calling me. Yes, you may do these things with my work because I am trying to be good and share some of what I have done, but I'm trying not to be stupid and give the whole thing away. So you're basically just creating a blanket license with limited rights. And that's not particularly original. Lawyers do that all the time. Usually we do it between two people. This one's interesting in that it's a blanket open use license, but you've been working subject to blanket licenses for a long time. That piece of paper that falls out when you rip open the shrink wrap, the print on both sides very densely, terms and conditions, the thing that you click through on the internet, I agree. Yeah, that's an open license. Those licenses, now with those, read those sometime. Wow, those EULAs are fun. The one where you agree to Bill Gates' towel boy, there, it's in there. I actually read through one of them a number of years ago. There is, in the standard Microsoft EULA, a disclaimer saying that you're using my program, blah, 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 you're licensing, blah, blah, blah. There's actually a disclaimer in there for damage caused by nuclear war in case this product is defective. I wish I were making that up, but I'm not. There's a clause in there where they disclaim nuclear annihilation based on bugs in their system.
Someone gets mad at Windows and just hits
It made me worried because I wasn't quite sure. I thought I was just installing Word.
I don't think they're up to Word. I think they're still using punch cards in Pentagon.
Great minds like Lawrence Lessig have pointed out that many of the caveats of the Digital Malicious Corrupt Our Rights Act are actually unconstitutional.
Good guys, bad guys. You may have noticed their opinion on it there.
Well, there's huge gray areas, and unfortunately, they've got a lot of those were codified by corporate entities with the DMCA.
Oh, I mean, when I was talking about DMCA a minute ago, you noticed I was talking about, you know, the authors were concerned about this, so it's in the law. There was a lobbying step in the middle there. The recording industry didn't actually write the law. AOL didn't actually write the law. They hired lobbyists to write the law that the Senate has been passed. And that's the process.
Well, that's a process. A lot of it is unconstitutional. What is your stand on that?
Nothing in there is unconstitutional.
Hasn't been challenged in the courts yet. Are you going to see that happen?
Nothing in there is unconstitutional. It's stupid. Some pieces of it are dumb. You really don't have a constitutional right to hack.
No, but there are issues, a lot of issues of fair use that it crossed the line on. And I know fair use is not really well defined, but also...
We talked about fair use a little bit earlier, and fair use is interesting. I'll be more than happy to talk to you about this as long as you want to. That's not really where we're going with this panel right now. Tomorrow's actually is probably going much further in that direction. But the fair use is a... The short answer to that is fair use is not a constitutional right either. Mm-hmm. So you can't, something is only unconstitutional if you have a constitutional right to do it. It's unconstitutional to curtail free speech, but you can obviously curtail some free speech. There are different kinds of speech and there are different things you're allowed to do to curtail it. No constitutional rights are absolute, so you can so the law is allowed to define some of that. The law is allowed to take reasonable steps to define what your rights are, and you've got no right to hack or copy or use something in a fair use fashion. That's all codified. That's not constitutional.
Well, we do have rights to purchase rights to material to display it in the means that we choose as appropriate, and to make backup copies. A lot of that is fair use.
You started with asking about that being unconstitutional, and none of that is constitutional issues. That's all just legal. I mean, it's statutes. The Copyright Act gives you certain rights. The Constitution does not address any of that. So the people who want to claim that the DMCA is unconstitutional are just wrong.
Okay.
There's just no constitutional aspect of that whatsoever.
Final question then is, how do we undo the DMCA? How do we get our rights back?
Hire better lawyers.
buy better legislators. Buy better legislators. Pay them enough money, they'll do anything.
Do come tomorrow. A lot of what we're going to discuss tomorrow is right down that track. But the short answer there is lawyers suck at technology, and politicians are lawyers, and politicians do what they can to write laws. We'll give them for now the benefit of the doubt that they're trying to do a good thing. And, you know, when I was talking about the DMCA earlier, there were some legitimate rights and concerns of rights holders that were trying to protect their rights to their stuff. And the DMCA was a way that they tried to do that. And that ISPs were trying to protect themselves so that AOL didn't get sued every time someone put porn up illegally. They were trying to protect themselves reasonably from unreasonable things, and the law has both good and negative effects. The people who want to be able to use everything freely all the time, I believe you're one of them, are really pissed about the law because it curtails your right to use other people's stuff. And some of it's done in a dumb way. When lawyers try to legislate about technology, we are just really stupid. And so we try to do good things, and it doesn't necessarily work out the way it's supposed to. And that, of course, is true of law in general, not just law and technology, but it's worse with law and technology. Yeah.
My question is more about parody. Because it seems to walk a fine line. I'm not talking about someone drawing a picture of Superman, because that's going to come to your trademark, but where someone makes...
Superman is an interesting one, because when you have a cartoon characters like that, you have both a trademark right and a copyright.
Right.
Characters and cartoon characters especially can be copyrighted.
Someone makes a Harry Potter parody, and it's not word for word, but the plot and ideas are still similar, just a few changes.
Parody is one of the things that's in the Copyright Act as a protected fair use. It is expressly allowed to, it's like academic use, you can use it for a parody. What's a parody? Now, actually, the lawyer who I mentioned who keeps being responsible for really bad law in the 11th Circuit was behind one of the last parody cases. He took something that was not a parody. I'm sorry, parody. We all know what that is. It's supposed to be funny. Apparently, there are enough academics in very tall ivory towers who are not just negotiating how many aims are ahead of a pen, but what's the nature of humor? Well, apparently, humor does not have to be funny. At all. And so basically, if your lawyer is Joe Beck, you can just knock off any crap you want and call it parody, and you'll be allowed to get away with it. And that's one of the things that's happened to fair use. It's being stretched in stupid ways. When you see a law being stretched in stupid ways, it's going to snap back at another point. So right now, we're in a kind of an expanding phase of the universe in fair use. It's going to crunch in on us in a bit. It hasn't yet. But parody is a protected use of fair use. So I said, when I was talking about being able to do things for critical reviews and analysis and those sorts of things, apparently we have a sense of humor also, because it's not just critical reviews, it's also funny shit. So you can make fun of something as long as the basic rule of thumb there is, if I am using your underlying work so that my work is cooler, because you have a famous book and I'm just going to kind of ride on your coattails and I'm really just bootstrapping my work, using yours to make mine look better, and I'm calling it funny, I can't do that. If I really am, there was one of the cases, this is back around the O.J. Simpson trial. Someone wrote a O.J. Simpson poem of sorts to Dr. Seuss' Cat in the Hat about the glove fitting. It was marginally clever. I won't recite it for you, because I got killed in the brain cells a couple weeks ago. But so they had, you know, obvious Dr. Seuss' Cat in the Hat prose done to the O.J. Simpson, the glove doesn't fit thing. Well, there's no reason in the world that Dr. Seuss had anything to do with O.J. Simpson. So that parody was not allowed, because you were just using Dr. Seuss for the sake of making your work funnier and better, not because there was really any connection between the parody, what you were parodying, and what you were doing it with. O.J. Simpson, Cat in the Hat, yeah, not so much. You're just stealing my clever prose and my clever rhyme scheme to make your take on O.J. look more clever. On the other hand, the Roy Orbison case, Pretty Woman, the rap version of it, which was intended to be a parody of the nicer, older times when people believed in love and romance. Well, yeah, they went a long way around the barn to get there, but they were using an older, more naive song, and they twisted it around and made it dirty. But they were using the naive boy meets girl kind of song to make a statement about Sex and the City today. Those two were related enough, that kind of parody was allowed. So there has to be some kind of nexus between what you're taking and what you're doing with it. Are we? Okay, we actually are about running low on time, aren't we? I can do one or two more questions, I think? Okay, you're in the back, I think, for next.
Yeah, regarding copyrights, are there myths or facts that probably
any myths about copyright?
Yeah.
Well, the big one is don't bother mail it to yourself. I always hear that one. If you put your work in an envelope and mail it to yourself so it's date stamped and never open it up, you'll win your lawsuit. Yeah, that's just stupid. Don't do that. The one about notice is widely misunderstood. You don't have to have a copyright notice. Just because there is no copyright notice doesn't mean the author wants you to steal it or will allow you to steal it. Shy of that, I could go through lots of stupid things my student believe, but I'm not going to. I promise you in the back I'd answer your question. Oh, tomorrow we're talking about, y'all just, well, since I'm closing up, let me pimp the thing that I'm talking about tomorrow. You have the audience set up real well, Scott. I appreciate it. Tomorrow we're talking about kind of patent versus copyright for software. Basically, why copyright is such a stupid vehicle to try to protect anything technical, software, computer systems, those sorts of things. Copyright technically applies to them, and boy, that was stupid. And that kind of gets into dumb things Congress has done. And so that's what we're talking about tomorrow. It's at 2:30 tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel, different lawyer address.
I'll be here.
One last question.
Yeah.
Is there some place that you could recommend where Joe Average, like us, could look into the copyright law?
Go to the copyright site. They have FAQs on there, and it's fairly good. There are a lot of really bad books.
Yeah.
Go to the
EFF. Well, by golly, I guess we can fill an hour and a half up.
Thank you. That was very useful.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Where do you lecture?
I teach Emory.